Both sides are responsible for it, and both sides seem resigned to it.
Coverage of the sequester offers an object lesson in false equivalence. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. With the imminent selection of a new pope, a Catholic blogger speculates on the possibilities.
When the pope himself knows how to go on the internet and knows how to read comment boxes or Twitter, he sees the world without a filter, and that takes the world's last great gilded cage and shatters it.
Also, a man who went from town to town persuading parents to pay to put their kids in a movie he made over and over again.
My favorite aspect to his personality that I've been able to discover is that he actually hated children. He loved dogs.
There's more coming up after this.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is a free service of WNYC Radio. Go to onthemedia.org to find out where On the Media is playing in your area and to support your local public radio station. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. News of the sequester was inescapable this week. Sweeping budget cuts, which, if they're allowed to go through on March 1st, could seriously damage the economy. Who's to blame? Everybody!
Both sides are responsible for it, and both sides seem resigned to it.
You have a set of politicians who, on both sides, who are unwilling to deal with something that they created because it was a way for them to kick the can down the road.
Now the only question is, who's going to get the blame?
This all feels very familiar. Last month it was the looming debt ceiling disaster. This month, the sequestration. Different name, same ominous rumblings of financial ruin. In his State of the Union address, President Obama made reference to the syndrome.
The greatest nation on earth cannot keep conducting its business by drifting from one manufactured crisis to the next.
But that's just what we seem to be doing. This latest crisis began in 2011 when, as you'll recall, Republicans demanded huge cuts in exchange for raising the debt limit, which Democrats wanted to do. They hammered out a compromise that would raise the debt ceiling while the so-called super committee found ways to cut spending and raise revenue agreeable to both sides. But the super committee failed, so next month, sequestration will kick in. $1.2 trillion of cuts over 10 years that would hurt everyone. And everyone's to blame.
Mainstream media are happy when they can point fingers at everybody. Nonpartisan blame has no political downside. The problem with the shame on everyone false equivalency is that it doesn't answer basic questions you might have about the sequester. New York Magazine writer Jonathan Chait says he's found a perfect example of this phenomenon, a Washington Post op-ed that dismissed the Republican position on the sequester, argued against the feasibility of the Democrats' position, even though the paper had previously supported it, and omitted the president's position altogether. All this, says Chait, was in the name of appearing nonpartisan.
I know that the Post agrees with Obama's general position on the deficit. The proposition that there needs to be some balance between revenue and cuts to retirement programs is exactly the stated position the Post has. Omitting this is bizarre. It sure seemed to me that the Post was caught between its desire to be nonpartisan and the fact that on this issue it happens to agree with President Obama, and so was forced to work away this contradiction by just ignoring Obama's actual position.
This need to appear nonpartisan, is this more common in some areas than in others?
It's extremely common on the deficit. The problem is this. Neutral reporters and self-styled centrist commentators almost uniformly agree that the deficit is a vital, urgent problem and that it's crucial to address this problem through a combination of higher tax revenue and lower spending on retirement programs, and end up advocating for a position, thinking that they're not actually advocating it because it's merely a sort of public good that everyone who knows anything understands must happen. The problem is that their position is embraced by one of the parties and not by the other. They're caught in a quandary. They can't concede that one of the parties actually agrees with them. so to maintain their nonpartisanship while advocating for a position in the debate that one of the parties has taken, they have to conceal the fact that one of the parties actually agrees with them and misleadingly present the issue as one where neither party agrees with them.
A news consumer that wants balanced news doesn't want to go to partisan news sources. So they go to nonpartisan places, and then they get nonpartisan to the point where they aren't being informed?
Well, I think that can actually happen. Partisanship can infect news coverage, and it can infect opinion commentary and introduce a bias. The problem is, if you only correct for that bias, and you go so far as to define non-biased in a way that prevents you from accurately describing differences between the parties, then you've not corrected the bias, you've simply replaced it with a different kind of bias.
The other kinds of biases have to do with
a priori centrism that defines the correct position as necessarily being the middle ground between the two parties at all times.
You know, exploring this conundrum with you leaves me open to charges like the one that was hurled at me by conservative John Sununu prior to the election.
As usual, you, part of the liberal press that will cover this president's butt across the board, you're going to lose in November.
So what do I say to Sununu?
Well, my answer here isn't that neutral reporters should advocate Obama's position. Because the problem is, once they've started advocating a position, especially on this issue, then they're caught in a trap where they can't describe the positions of the parties honestly without seeming biased. But I think it's worth noting that if you're dedicated to stopping that kind of bias, but not aware of the other kind of bias, you can make equally ridiculous mistakes in the other direction.
Jonathan, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Jonathan Chait is a writer for New York Magazine.
The Atlantic's James Fallows believes that the failures we're seeing in the sequestration coverage bespeak a larger problem with our political system and the press that's supposed to cover it. Jim, welcome back to OTM.
Thank you very much, Bob.
You say the political system is broken in a historically unprecedented way. You know, McCarthy era, the abolitionist struggle, more than that?
I am careful always to say that the Civil War was worse than anything else you want to put up. And I think the excesses and failures of the Gilded Age match up in many ways with the problems of the United States in the early 21st century. The structural breakdown of the Senate in particular is unusual in the history of modern times, in that the polarization has become so great that what had always been a theoretical right of individual senators in the Senate minority, which is to stop anything in its tracks, has become a routinely used and abused habit. And so the Senate works differently from the way it did 10 years ago, 50 years ago, 80 years ago.
You're describing political gridlock. What are the markers?
You would see a very steep rise in the proportion of Senate action that is stopped by a filibuster, which we have indeed seen. You would see great slowness in confirming nominees, not simply the lifetime appointments like judgeships, but any sort of routine appointment necessary to staff the executive branch. We've seen that too. We've seen a Supreme Court whose votes seem more and more like those that the Senate casts on party lines. And that was the significance of Chief Justice Roberts's having the ruling in favor of the Obama medical care system last year was the first sort of step away from that. You would also see, particularly in the Senate, essentially a vanishing middle where the most conservative Democratic senator is more liberal than the most liberal Republican senator. When the Senate has gotten most things done, there was a sort of overlap of the Venn diagram with people who were either Republicans or Democrats who sometimes went the other way.
But we have a robust and aggressive press that is uniquely qualified to identify the problem and to lead us to solutions, right?
As always, you've helped us look on the bright side. I think the problem for most of the established press, it has, of course, its business problems we're all coping with and everything else, but its model of covering politics is matched to a kind of politics that doesn't exist right now. Its model of politics is essentially that of being a referee, where you assume the two competitors have equal motivations, and you're there simply to call balls and strikes, again, as Justice Roberts said. If you have a situation where the two parties are disagreeing on basic facts as was, for instance, the case about the Barack Obama birth certificate nuttiness a few years ago, or if you have one party that believes its essential political mission is to obstruct things from getting done rather than to find some compromise that will allow them to be done, which I think was the case during the debt ceiling showdown in 2011, it's very hard for the mainstream press to cover these things because its instinct is never to say this side has the more rational case. It can do that when endorsing presidential candidates every 4 years, but there is also almost an atavistic horror at doing that among many mainstream reporters. And so I think that's why the press's instincts in saying what is going on are mismatched to the reality of what is going on.
I'd be delighted to see balls and strikes being called. But what I'm seeing is the umpire going, strike. On the other hand, the batter believes it's a ball, so let's hear what he has to say.
Yeah, who can say? And I think that actually is, I'm glad to have this analogy from you, which I'll use in my future discussions of this topic, because there was a time, and again, there's never been a golden age in American history, but a generation ago, you could say that the two political parties were sort of equally committed to presenting a rational version of their case. And then the press would say, well, here is how we see it. The Republicans say this, but the Democrats say that. You, the informed readership, judge for yourself. In cases like the birth certificate controversy and everything thereafter, the press was saying, well, the registrar in Hawaii says Barack Obama was born there. That's what Obama says, too, and his parents always said. But Donald Trump thinks they're all making it up. Judge for yourself. It's very, very hard to referee these fundamental conflicts over what is the nature of reality.
Jim, as always, thank you.
My pleasure, Bob.
James Fallows is national correspondent for The Atlantic. Coming up, how an offhand joke became a serious headline.
And I said something like, I have heard these rumors that Hagel has talked to groups that are controversial for fees. Do you know if they actually know of specific instances where maybe he talked to group X that was controversial? For example, did he talk to the Junior League of Hezbollah? Did he talk to Friends of Hamas? I didn't think about it until I saw an article on Slate.com. Somehow I had completely missed that this group name had become a little firestorm among conservative parts of the internet.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the internet. More at Reputation.com and 1-800-REPUTATION. Support for On the Media also comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. At GatesFoundation.org, the Pew Charitable Trusts, working to support U.S. innovation and competitiveness in a global clean energy economy. At PewTrust.org, and the SCAN Foundation, committed to aging with dignity and independence. At theScanFoundation.org, this is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. If President Obama has his way, former Senator Chuck Hagel will be the country's next Secretary of Defense. But Hagel's path hasn't been smooth. He's been bedeviled with the perception that he's anti-Israel. Throwing fuel on that fire was the conservative site Breitbart.com, which suggested in a story that Hagel had secret financial ties to a group called Friends of Hamas. If he had received money from a terrorist organization that had called for Israel's destruction, that could be a problem. But it wasn't true. In fact, it was actually a joke that took on the power of rumor. And Dan Friedman, who covers Washington for the New York Daily News, was probably the source.
There was a letter from, I think it was 26 Republican senators to Hagel asking him if he had gotten money from foreign groups or foreign governments in his career after the Senate. And I was asking a couple people if those senators knew the actual instances. And in one conversation with a Senate aide, I threw out hypothetical what I thought would be obviously fictional, over-the-top names.
Let me be the Senate aide. Ring, ring, ring. Hello, this is the Republican aide for a senator. Who's on the line?
This is Dan Friedman with the New York Daily News, and this is not a direct transcript, but I said something like, I have heard these rumors that Hagel has talked to groups that are controversial for fees. Do you know if they actually know of specific instances where maybe he talked to Group X that was controversial? For example, did he talk to the Junior League of Hezbollah? Did he talk to Friends of Hamas? This is not the first time I've talked to this person. I thought that it was understood that this was not an actual name. The person said they would check. I followed up with an email which said, again, if you know of any controversial groups, please let me know. Did he get a $25,000 fee from Friends of Hamas? I didn't think about it until I saw an article on Slate.com. Somehow I had completely missed that this group name had become a little firestorm among conservative parts of the internet.
Most notably, on February 7th, on the conservative website Breitbart.com, the headline, Secret Hagel Donor? White House Spock's Ducks Question on Friends of Hamas. What does that mean?
Ben Shapiro, he writes for Breitbart.com, called the White House to try to get them to comment on this alleged rumor, and the White House spokesman hung up on him. And that is cited in the story as a suggestion that perhaps this is true, or at least they didn't deny it.
So your best guess is that Ben Shapiro, Breitbart's editor-at-large, either heard from the aide that you spoke to or from someone that the aide spoke to, right? And so then you wrote a story.
It seemed almost impossible to be anything other than the case that it had started with my email. I had asked this question on February 6th, and the story that alleged this Friends of Hamas appeared the next day. So I wrote a story after conferring with my editors on Tuesday, which sort of explained my own role in this and how it appeared that a perhaps slightly flippant query that I had made emerged reported as fact or close to it.
Shapiro tweeted the link to his nearly 40,000 Twitter followers, blogs like RedState.com and the National Review's The Corner linked to it. Mike Huckabee said from Israel that rumors of Chuck Hagel's having received funds from Friends of Hamas would, if true, disqualify him. It got around, but Ben Shapiro says that he had multiple sources on this story.
He says that the person he talked to told him that multiple people asked him about it after this had been reported on this website. They didn't originate it. And the reason that I know that they didn't originate it is because I made it up, because it was a hypothetical that came from my brain.
Now, in response to your story, Shapiro is quoted as saying, "The story, as reported, is correct. Whether the information I was given by the source is correct, I am not sure."
His standard was that he felt that the story is correct because it is true that the source told him, if you read the caveats that he puts in there, something like this. Where I work, you need to have a few sources and you need to believe that this is fact. But, you know, to his credit, he understands very well that distinction and he says a different standard applies to what he writes. I said, "Do you consider yourself an objective journalist?" And he said, "No, I do not. I have a conservative agenda. I want Chuck Hagel to be defeated."
I noticed that your source may not have protected you, but you're still protecting your Senate source.
I don't see how that would make anything better. To be honest, it also not helped me as I move forward with my job, and I need to continue to talk to people, and it's a chance for me to say that kind of agreement is pretty ironclad, hopefully, when I make it.
What about joking on the phone and in emails?
Well, I wouldn't do it again like that. People may not realize how much interaction there is between some staff and reporters who cover Capitol Hill. You get to know them and you have lunch with them. Maybe you have drinks with them and you do joke around and they're going to cover Congress. Who should they be talking to? I mean, the staff is the best source on many of these things. But a trade-off with that is it's very hard to avoid what might appear to outsiders as overly chummy relationships with some of the people that you talk to.
Dan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dan Friedman is the New York Daily News' Washington correspondent. We asked Ben Shapiro for a comment, but we didn't hear back.
After the initial shock following Pope Benedict's sudden resignation last week, plans swung into motion for the next Vatican conclave to appoint a new pontiff.
The usual reporters on the Pope beat will be joined by a global horde of journalists in every medium. Among them will be Rocco Palmo, who usually covers the Catholic Church from his home in Philadelphia. His blog, Whispers in the Loggia, is widely read and widely praised, including by NPR, which called it a must-read for church insiders. Palmo co-chaired the Vatican's first-ever social media conference and has cultivated a stable of sources that gives him eyes and ears inside the papacy. Palmo says he owes much of his success in building relationships in Rome to his hometown.
I grew up in a very thickly Catholic culture here in Philadelphia. In this city, even Jews don't identify themselves by what neighborhood they come from, but what Catholic parish they come from. And so as a young kid, I got to meet the cardinal then at the time, Anthony Bevilacqua, and I just had a lot of dumb questions and started asking them. And, you know, 22 years later, here we are.
You break so many scoops. You have sources that may be unparalleled. How do you cultivate sources in this extremely secretive culture?
At least for me, it feels like second nature. When you know how to speak the language, it's not hard. Because when somebody can talk to me and know that I understand when they talk about Sacrosanctum Concilium, the Vatican II document which allowed the Mass to be celebrated in vernacular languages, that alone opens up a lot of doors. It's also just a sense of knowing how the system works. And, you know, one concern of mine going into this conclave is that religion reporters in general, the major outlets in this country, whether broadcast or print, are an endangered species. And you can't be a GA reporter thrown into this story because you're not going to understand the basics of the Catholic Church, let alone the nuances.
You mentioned that you came up kind of under the wing of the man who would become cardinal, a man who eventually came under a tremendous amount of criticism for the way his diocese covered up the accusations of sexual abuse against children by priests. The cardinal died. How did you cover the story?
Bevilacqua retired in 2003. By that point, of course, the national sex abuse scandal had erupted. There had already been a first grand jury in 2005 that levied no charges, but was very damning in terms of Bevilacqua's handling of sex abuse cases and his administration's handling of them. And then there was a second grand jury in February 2011, which did levy criminal charges for the first time in the English-speaking world against one of his deputies. And the grand jury came just short of charging the cardinal. But even for my bun with him, the role of the journalist is to be honest. So amidst this very tumultuous scene, almost a year since the grand jury, I get a call late one night from a newsroom here in Philly. And an aide in the newsroom said, "Can you confirm to us that Bevilacqua is dead?" Out of nowhere. You know, the person who changed the course of my life. I almost dropped the phone and started screaming. But the second thought was, all right, you got to write this. And you got to write it honestly. And I could show or imply my bond with him. But what the grand jury said, I can't change.
In the press box at, let's say, the Phillies game, the local reporters are not permitted to root for the Phillies. Your roots in the church are so deep. What kind of tension does that create for you in trying to cover the church as a news beat?
Even if you're a beat writer for the team, you can't come in hating the team. You can't come in talking about changing the rules of the game. You have to cover what happens on the field. And if your team lost 15-0, you can't say, well, they won 8-7. You got to say what it is. It may drive you crazy sometimes. It may, you know, make you cry. Because sports and religion, and especially coming from a town like Philly, they're almost the same thing.
Conclave or no conclave, if you were to somehow get a hold of the name before it was announced to the world, do you break that story?
That's the scoop of a lifetime. Don't expect me to do it. In that moment, you step back, you give it 5 minutes. It would be a golden scoop, but you know, it's the kind of thing I'd give up. If there should be one scoop-free moment in the world, it's when the senior cardinal deacon comes out and proclaims Habemus Papam and tells us who the Pope is.
You've mentioned Pope Benedict's isolation. I'm curious first whether you think that his papacy was damaged by that isolation, and whether you believe that his successor, whoever that may be, will be more exposed to the outside world, and the outside world have a more transparent view of him.
You can take it to the bank that the Catholic Church is going to emerge from this conclave with a pope who, for the first time, is going to be used to having a computer on his desk and probably a smartphone in his pocket and quite possibly an iPad on the coffee table. When the pope himself knows how to go on the internet and knows how to read comment boxes or Twitter, he sees the world without a filter, and that takes the world's last great gilded cage and shatters it.
Do you think that the digital revolution is going to fundamentally change how the church as a whole interacts with the outside world?
I grew up in the newsroom. My father worked for the Philadelphia newspapers for 30 years. And what I see in my father, intriguingly enough, I've seen in many priests, that kind of cataclysm, that kind of severe stress, because the demands and the changing nature of things are not what they signed up for. And it's intriguing because, you know, the press and the church are traditionally seen as being at loggerheads with each other. But, you know, both in terms of the nitty-gritty of the day-to-day, but in terms of the concept of what both do, they're really the same. They're both looking for the truth.
Rocco, thank you very much.
Anytime, Bob. Thank you.
Rocco Palmo will be covering the Vatican Conclave from Rome on his blog, Whispers in the Loggia.
The Memphis newspaper, The Commercial Appeal, agreed in principle with the FBI this month to settle a lawsuit that's likely to give the paper more access to the files of Ernest Withers. Withers, who died in 2007 at the age of 85, may have been the preeminent photographer of the civil rights movement. Among his iconic pictures, one shot in court against the judge's orders of Emmett Till's great uncle pointing a bony finger at the men accused of killing his nephew. And sanitation workers in Memphis holding up "I am a man" signs. Withers was there with his camera on the day Martin Luther King was killed. Withers was beaten by police as he marched alongside King at Medgar Evers' funeral. But according to the files on Withers already obtained by the Memphis Commercial Appeal, Withers was also a paid informant for the FBI, codename ME338R. Commercial Appeal reporter Mark Paraschia broke the story in 2010. It began with a tip from a source years earlier.
He told me back in 1997 that Mr. Withers had been an informant, but my source told me, if you ever write that, I'll deny it. I'd save my notes. 2007, Mr. Withers died. At that point, I filed a Freedom of Information Act request, knowing that when a person has passed on, their privacy rights are diminished. But even then, it was a huge uphill battle because the law protects informants even after death.
You wrote that Withers was an ideal informant because he had extraordinary access.
He had a great feel for people, a great memory for faces and names, and he was a freelance photographer working for essentially the black press at the time. You know, he knew everybody.
And they all, you wrote, ended up with FBI files. A school teacher, a Democratic Party member, a real estate agent, a pastor. Can you tell me some of the things that the FBI learned from Withers?
The period that we have to see at this point is the sanitation strike.
You are reminding not only Memphis, but you are reminding the nation that it is a crime for people to live in this rich nation and receive starvation wages.
The big fear was not the movement itself, but militancy that had grafted itself onto the movement. And so he was giving them leaflets. He was passing on tips from meetings. He was taking all sorts of pictures. Dr. King's funeral in Atlanta. He calls the FBI back in Memphis and tells them a couple of Dr. King's aides are coming back to Memphis to continue helping with the sanitation strike. People would get caught in the crosshairs. A lady who was working for the U.S. Civil Rights Commission in Memphis, there are reports in which an informant who is clearly Withers is taking pictures of her and giving them to the FBI. The informant says she is one who will give comfort and aid to the black power groups.
Why do you think he did it?
I think he had multiple motives. Ernest Withers always wanted to be a cop. As a matter of fact, back in the late 40s, he was part of the Memphis Police Department's first black recruit class, worked there 3 years, wound up getting fired. He was caught in some kickback scheme at the time. Years later, after the civil rights movement, he gets a patronage job with the state as a gun-carrying agent of the Alcoholic Beverage Commission. He's also a patriot. He fought in the Army in World War II. He's a conservative, really. And then also, we don't know how much he got paid. The FBI was notoriously tight-fisted, but he had 8 children. He needed to raise a family.
You also suggest that he resented the growing power of groups that really were militant, groups like the Invaders who were active in Memphis.
He told his friends he was suspicious of them, and you can tell in the various reports he's distrustful. At the same time, he befriends many of them, and I've interviewed several of them who felt Ernest Withers was their best friend, dear friend, they would refer to him, my dad.
So what of his legacy? Plans to name a building after Withers, a proposed museum to preserve his archives? Can we live with 2 Withers, or is it too much cognitive dissonance?
It will always be ambiguous. He took these very vivid, poignant pictures that, you know, will live on in our history. It's a little complicated now, but some people want to say he betrayed the movement, betrayed the black community. That's their opinion.
You don't think he did? Those people whose jobs were threatened because they were seen in the company of members of a militant group?
I'm just going to leave that for others to decide. You know, there's certainly individual episodes that, you know, one could argue there's some betrayal there.
Well, you don't have all the information yet, but based on what you have, which Withers had the greater impact?
I would say Withers, the photographer. Those images are going to live forever. The I Am the Man pictures, you know, no matter what comes out on him, that's what's going to live on, and that's what the larger public will remember.
Mark, thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Mark Paraskia is a reporter at the Commercial Appeal.
Coming up, the man who made the same movie again and again and again.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the Internet. More at Reputation.com and 1-800-REPUTATION. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Video games allow a player to personify a space marine, a kung fu master, a Jedi knight, or in the case of David S. Gallant's game, I get this call every day, a call center operator. The goal here isn't to save the universe or stop a mad scientist. It's simply to help a caller change the address you have on file. It's based on the real-life job that recently Gallant held at the Canada Revenue Agency. Gallant's game, I Get This Call Every Day, effectively captures the angst of the crappy 9-to-5.
It's very similar to what you would call a point-and-click adventure, except there's no adventure. You're essentially staring at a single screen. You have a computer in front of you. You have a telephone. Every once in a while, you're prompted to create a response. You're given the option, essentially, to either be polite and patient with this person who is not prepared to answer the questions that they need to in order to change their address, or be a little rude.
What was your net income last year?
Is that how much I made?
Yes, that is essentially your net income.
I don't know. I think I made about $10,000 last year.
I'm sorry, that doesn't match our records.
$15,000?
Now you're just guessing.
You also have the option of bending the rules to try and help the person out in this situation. Taking those variations will inevitably result in the agent getting fired.
Is it possible to win the game?
No, and that's the point. The game is called a personal tale of unwinnable realities. Even under the most polite option, the person still can't answer the security questions, and the call will simply end with you asking the person to try again.
Whatever, I'll just call back.
No problem. Thanks for calling, sir. Have a nice day. Sir, I'm still on the line.
I'm hoping to inspire a little bit of empathy. I've been successful in that. A lot of people do exclaim to me how much they want to punch their computer screens or never work in call centers ever.
Now, you said earlier that the conclusion of the game might be that you get fired. You actually got fired.
You know, the game had been covered by, you know, sort of the gaming press a little bit, but it very spontaneously also got covered by one of the national newspapers in Canada.
We're talking about the Toronto Star.
That article really leaned into the angle that this was by an agent of Canada Revenue Agency. Canada Revenue Agency is essentially the IRS of the North. When someone had a question about their taxes, whether it's to change their address or find out if something could be claimed on their taxes, that was the position that I was in up until recently, is just answering questions like those.
Now, when the reporter contacted your workplace, she received this response. Quote, "The minister considers this type of conduct offensive and completely unacceptable."
Minister of Revenue Gail Shea, who provided that quote, I don't believe she actually played the game. And I'm not convinced she would find it offensive if she had actually taken the time to experience it.
Now, in spite of losing your job, it seems as if the gaming community and the gaming press have rallied around you.
I've been supported both by the local game development community in Toronto and the wider game development community around the world. Not only encouraging people to buy it to support me now that I'm out of work, but also writing articles questioning whether this was a matter of wrongful dismissal, holding the game up as an example of games as art. It's been utterly overwhelming.
You've made a little money on it, right?
To date, it's $6,700. More than I would have made in a few months of work at my previous employers. And ironically, income that I will have to consider the tax implications of.
Let's stipulate that for psychological reasons, this was the game you had to make. What's the one that you dreamed of making when you were at your day job?
And maybe this makes me sound like more of a nerd than I already am, but I want to make income taxes fun. When I started working at Canada Revenue Agency, I was fascinated by income taxes. If I could use the medium of games to make it something that people don't dread and rather even possibly enjoy working with, I'd love to be able to explore that.
Boy, David, that sounds like a very hard sell. What about another game that works out one's psychological issues?
There's more experiences that came from this job that I possibly would like to express. You know, I've dealt with some desperate people who I've wanted to help and been unable to. You know, an individual is facing eviction, has three kids, and because of a simple error with an address are now not going to receive child benefits for 3 months. Individuals who are trying to help out a relative who is in a vegetative state but have never been granted the proper authority to deal with their information and never can be because that person is not in a position to grant that authority. Not being able to help those people made me feel like less of a human being. You know, write us a letter. In 2 to 4 weeks, maybe we'll get to it. If I were to make another game like this, that's where I'd go with it.
So you'd go from something that plays a little like a Saturday Night Live sketch to something that's much closer to Kafka.
The irony is that I modeled it very closely over a real situation that I deal with and never really found it to be funny. It's not where I intended to be with it. I actually sort of expected it to be a little existential.
David, thank you very much.
Thank you.
David S. Gallant is a game developer.
And now a little movie talk. David Rothschild is a Microsoft researcher who accurately predicted the results of the 2012 presidential race in every state but Florida. Now he's using his powers of prediction on another major event, the Academy Awards. His predictions are data-driven, having nothing to do with whether or not the chase scene at the end of Argo was completely implausible, or if Silver Linings Playbook devolved from a quirky character study to a pat romantic comedy.
I've seen actually very few of these movies, and it really needs to be that way, because once you start throwing your gut in, you're into a world of trouble, because in the long run, data beats gut every time.
Some of the data points that you follow are a little surprising. For example, first week box office, not such a big indicator, but the actual window of the release is.
a movie that's released in the fall is much more likely to get nominated than another given movie released in the spring. But if a movie that is released in the spring ends up getting nominated, there's something special there. So it's a very weird game thinking about what things kind of correlate with the likelihood of getting nominated, but then conditional on being nominated, what correlates with outcomes during the Oscars. Whether or not a movie was gaining or losing gross between the fourth and fifth week is a really key indicator. If a movie was rated high by the general population versus critics, this was much more important, completely dwarfed out the critical ratings. If you have been nominated many times before but haven't won, that's a good chance that that's going to be your year. But then if you've been nominated a bunch of times and have won, that kind of offsets that entire bump.
Now, a few moments ago, we're speaking on Thursday, I got some extremely bad news. My wife walked into my office and told me that she had purchased ballet tickets for Oscar night. Who's going to win?
Who's likely to win? Let's put it that way. You know, it's looking increasingly like Argo for Best Picture. Argo has won a lot of the previous awards. Right off the bat, Lincoln looked really strong by the fact that Steven Spielberg was nominated for Best Director and his counterpart, Ben Affleck, was not nominated from Argo for Best Director. But as the award season progressed, Argo has gained steam. Interestingly, Steven Spielberg seems even more likely now to win Best Director because his biggest competition, Mr. Affleck, is not in the race. Daniel Day-Lewis is just a runaway favorite for Best Actor. And then one of the more interesting categories, Best Actress, we have Jennifer Lawrence as a very likely favorite at about 70%. Jessica Chastain from Zero Dark Thirty was a much closer second place earlier on, but has really fallen down. The least exciting race was Anne Hathaway in Best Supporting Actress, which is a runaway at this point. Helen Hunt as an extremely distant second. By far of the big six, the tightest is going to be the Best Supporting Actor category. Tommy Lee Jones is the most likely, leading the pack here in the mid-40s percentage chance, over Christoph Waltz of Django Unchained at about 40%, and then Robert De Niro as a kind of distant but non-negligible third from Silver Linings Playbook.
I don't mean this quite the way it may sound, but who cares? I mean, it's an interesting parlor game. What's the greater significance of being able to put together this kind of prediction model?
That's a very reasonable question. And I actually, to tell you the truth, I don't care that much. I care because I think about the science of forecasting. It's fun and exciting, and it pulls people in to study popular events. And there's also a lot of data there, so it's a good place to start. But the real effort down the line is to build methods that are extremely domain independent. So the same sort of methods can be used for politics and for entertainment, for sports, for economic indicators, or business decisions that companies could be making. All these things that could be adding efficiency in the world, that's really why we're in this game.
David, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a real pleasure.
David Rothschild is a researcher for Microsoft. Our next story is about a film category not celebrated at the Oscars. In the first half of the 20th century, a small group of so-called itinerant filmmakers made a living traveling from small town to small town, charging residents to appear in movies where they and the town they lived in would be the stars. The practice mostly died out by the late 50s, but one man named Melton Barker, who started in the 30s, continued into the 70s. Barker's films were unique in that they were always exactly the same. For 40 years, he shot countless iterations of a movie called The Kidnapper's Foil. Caroline Frick, an assistant professor at the University of Texas at Austin, has spent years collecting prints of Kidnapper's Foil. Here's the plot.
The rich girl in town by the name of Betty Davis is kidnapped by two men. The father of Betty Davis offers a reward, and the gang, quote unquote, gets together to figure out how they can find Betty and get the reward. Once they, of course, find Betty, they rather inexplicably put on a talent show. So you have one reel that's about this kidnapping, very slim kidnapping narrative, and then a quick segue into a talent show.
Yeah, what were the talents? Just curious.
There were hundreds of these made, and we really only have about 20 of them. You sort of see in the 1930s, oh, children are going to be the next vaudeville entertainer or Shirley Temple or Bob Hope. So there's lots of tap dancing, and there's sort of a radio announcer type. And then as you get into the 50s, perhaps more interpretive dance, a lot of bad singing. But what's interesting is also that they select certain songs that have more regional appeal. So what, let's say, the children were singing in Childress, Texas in the 30s isn't going to resemble what was being done, let's say, in Pennsylvania.
Is it true what they say about me? Does the sun really shine all the time?
Melton Barker sounds for all the world like the Music Man, only, you know, instead of a marching band, he's got promises of cinema stardom. So is that what this guy was about? Was he a scam artist?
No. He was an entrepreneur who was a realist, and perhaps at times bluntly so. His marketing materials at one point in his career basically said, your children are never going to make it in Hollywood. Let's face it. You know it. I know it. Let me just take $10. We'll put them on the big screen in your local town, and this will be a lot of fun.
How did you stumble upon the kidnapper's foil?
It's funny. I've been searching and researching Barker for, sadly, over a decade now. It's become a little hazy. But I'd stumbled upon it, and I had worked at Warner Brothers in the film preservation department, preserving hundreds of children's short subjects. I think I became obsessed with the fact that Barker had made hundreds of films, hundreds and hundreds, and yet nobody knew about him. He'd made more films than Martin Scorsese, and nobody heard about him.
So here's a montage of the same scene involving a series of local little girls whose character's name, by the way, is Betty Davis. It's majestic.
Betty, Betty, my little sister, she's been kidnapped. Oh, what shall I do?
Betty, Betty, my little sister, she's been kidnapped. Oh, what shall I do? Dad, Dad, Dad.
Oh, Betty, Betty, my little sister, she's been kidnapped. Oh, what shall I do?
Dad. Betty, Betty, my little sister's been kidnapped. What shall I do?
It sounds like the outtakes from our gang comedies.
Oh, completely. I mean, it's actually really funny because who's been kidnapped is Betty Davis. Wink, wink. Right? So there is this kind of connection between our gang comedies, real Hollywood with a capital H, and these local versions. You're absolutely right. And, of course, Melton Barker liked to promote that he had discovered Spanky McFarland.
We're going to start our rally. We hope you like the show. Everything is ready. We're raring to go.
Apart from the beauty of the regional dialects and the kind of conceptual art aspects of doing the same movie 100-plus times, what makes this story so compelling to you?
One of the aspects to me as someone who is a historian at heart is looking at the depiction of our country over time in communities that aren't necessarily covered regularly in the national media. And in particular for me is the fact that he did this through the 50s, through the 60s, and into the 70s. And when you look at what children are learning today in the textbooks of what this country was going through in the 60s and 70s, you're not thinking of the kidnapper's foil. You're thinking of the civil rights movement. You're thinking of presidents being assassinated. There's a different tone, I think, and a different perspective that seems to emerge from the kidnapper's foil series.
And then there's the filmmaker himself. On the road for 30 or 40 years, remaking the same film, who was this guy?
An enigma. My favorite aspect to his personality that I've been able to discover is that he actually hated children. He loved dogs.
Did he have a life? Did he have a family?
I know that he was married a couple of times. Those marriages ended in divorce. He did not have any children of his own. The closest I've come was chatting with his former stepson, who didn't much remember him, and in fact, vaguely remembered that he was a filmmaker. Indeed, I don't think that Barker left much of a long-term impression, didn't have long-term relationships, but the impact that he had on lives in the short term is quite significant. When we have brought back prints of these films to communities, people are overjoyed. I have had hundreds, literally hundreds of emails from people saying, my family never believed I was in this movie. I remember this filmmaker who came to town. I would love more than anything to see a copy of it.
Have you, in your obsessive, compulsive, single-minded focus on the kidnapper's foil, become Melton Barker?
Well, as much as I would like to say that that's not a good question to ask, he is my spirit Texan. All of us at the Texas Archive of the Moving Image have a spirit Texan. And there is no doubt that, that Mel is mine. And I have started to make my own versions. It's true.
Is it true?
Yes. And the man was a genius, by the way. I did not realize he kept those children in sort of like sequestered groups based on age. Why? Because if you bring them all together like I did, disaster. I had kids in trees. I had kids running around. I don't know. The man was a genius.
You have picked up where Melton Barker left off.
For educational purposes, yes.
Oh, my. Caroline, thank you very, very much.
Well, thank you.
Caroline Frick is an assistant professor at the University of Texas Austin and executive director of the Texas Archive of the Moving Image. If you can sit through them, there are 10 streamable versions of The Kidnapper's Foil at Melton, that's M-E-L-T-O-N, Barker.org. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sarah Abdurkman, and Chris Neary. We had more help from Krista Ripple, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Rob Frankel.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news and our boss. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for listening to this week's On the Media podcast, a free service of WNYC Radio. Find out where On the Media is playing in your area and support your local public radio station by going to onthemedia.org. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.